Welcome to episode 34, the episode that we are releasing on May 22nd, 2007. And, of course, Stephen, is this a great episode?
I'm going to say yes, it is a great one.
Okay. All right. I just want to double check. All right. We got a great episode for you, starting with a Film Buff's Dictionary, where Stephen is going to continue about cinematographic terms. And then we'll have the trivia question, as always. A film spotlight about the movie Shortcuts by Robert Altman, a movie that I really, really love. And our top six list this week is going to be a quick one about the funniest movie titles. And we'll close with part two of our director's spotlight on Stanley Kubrick, which I'm really excited about. I'm Sam Stoddard.
I'm Stephen Keller, and I'd like to invite everyone to play along in our funny movie titles home game. Go ahead and take your iPod or your copy of iTunes, whatever you listen to this on, and get a magic marker. And where it displays our title, All Movie Talk, just go ahead and scratch that out and write in All Movie Talk : And now it's where you put in your wacky title for our show. So what you can do is have kind of like Mad Libs here. So you have a noun on a, so a plural noun on a, and then mode of transportation. So, you know, you could have, like, All Movie Talk, Forks on a Bus. And then you'd have the wacky title. Make sure you do that in permanent Sharpie or something on your music player. And then you'll get the full effect of this week's top six list.
Do we have to take that exact form? Because I just like comedy, and I think something like All Movie Talk and a Kick in the Pants would be a good title for. Actually, no, we should
Kick in the Pants.
We should really call the show that.
Oh, that's a great idea. Can
yeah,
we go,
like, that's a good one, isn't it?
Can we go do that? How hard is that technically to do?
To change the name of the show?
Yeah, can we do that? Is that legal? Man, I'm not filling out any paperwork. We're going to continue our discussion of cinematographic terms in our Film Buff Dictionary entry for this week, when we talk a little bit about high angle and low angle shots. And these are pretty simple things to grasp, actually. You'll hear them used a lot, but it's pretty important because these are pretty fundamental to the composition of movie shots. And a high angle shot refers to a shot which the camera is placed above eye level of the actors, and a low angle is going to be below eye level. Most shots, of course, the camera is right at about eye level because we're trying to make the audience feel as though they're there in the scene with the characters. And it makes sense, you know, you look at people and for the most part, most people's eyes are right about your eye level. So the camera, if it's being your surrogate, would also be right at about eye level of the characters. Now, there are some specific connotations that these shots have that make them useful to directors and cinematographers. For instance, a high-angle shot where you're looking down at somebody tends to diminish the person. I mean, it makes sense because it gives this sort of idea that you're higher than them, that this person is low, and you sort of also see the person within the environment pretty well. We talked, you know, a bit about how shots from a long distance away or really pulled out can change the way we see actors because we see them within the context of their environment. Well, the same thing is kind of true about high-angle shots. You see more of the environment that the person's in, and it tends to just diminish them a little bit. You know, you'll sometimes see this used when you want to illustrate the idea that someone is small and powerless. We talked way back when we talked about crane shots, about a really famous shot like this from the film High Noon, which the Gary Cooper character has basically been abandoned by all the townsfolk. He plays a sheriff in that movie who's, you know, this guy's coming to kill him, and he tries to get help from the town, and no one helps him. It was a really, really famous shot where they just pull out, and we see him alone in these empty streets, and it's a very high shot, and, you know, that's a great example of how someone can really feel diminished. You know, here we see him in the midst of this big environment, and we're way above him, so he looks small and powerless, which is exactly how he is within the context of the film's story. Now, a low-angle shot is, of course, the same idea, but opposite. You shoot someone from below eye level, and you can get, you know, really extreme here. It could be just a little bit below eye level, or it could be like practically putting the camera down on the floorboards. I mean, there actually are, I have been movies where literally they cut out part of the floor or something to mount the camera in there. And this is a technique that was really pioneered by somewhat in silent film. A lot of expressionists did a lot of low-angle stuff because it creates a really creepy and weird kind of atmosphere. I think we're a little more used to seeing a lot of high-angle shots than we are used to seeing low-angle shots. And part of that's because a high-angle shot can just be used as sort of an establishing shot. A lot of times you show something up high, you get that bird's-eye view, that crane shot, or that helicopter shot, which, you know, its main purpose is to just to give you an idea of the environment. Well, a low-angle shot is used almost exclusively to sort of make someone look powerful and imposing. It just kind of distorts things. You see the ceiling in low-angle shots a lot of times, which is not something you often see in movies, in part because if you're building a set, you don't a lot of times bother to finish the ceiling on a set, because if it's not going to be shown, no reason to. It's an extra expense to actually build a real ceiling. If you watch TV shows especially, you know, that make heavy, heavy use of sets, you'll almost never see a ceiling in like a sitcom or something. But really pioneered in America by Orson Welles, very famously used a lot of low-angle shots in Citizen Kane to give the idea of how powerful Kane is. Probably the most famous example is the scene where he fires the Joseph Cotton character. That seems to be shot from, you know, several feet below the floor. I mean, you see the ceilings and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty cool. And used a lot as well in film noir, and that kind of style where you want to have a lot of guys sitting behind desks and looking powerful. You know, you think the Coen brothers use this kind of shot a lot. Even some of that Quentin Tarantino has a real fondness for this shot. If you think of all the shots he likes to take from within the trunk of a car with two people sort of standing over it, and those two people are almost always pretty powerful. One interesting thing worth talking about, we talked before about Sidney Lumet's book Making Movies, and there's a really fascinating, really small section in there, though, where he talks about the camera, and he gives an example of his film 12 Angry Men, and in which he developed what he called a lens strategy for the film. In addition to switching between different focal length lenses for the film, he also consciously shot, the first third of the film is shot from above the actors, and you can kind of see them within their environments. They don't look that powerful, but it's just a bunch of guys sort of talking. They're deliberating on the fate of a man. You know, they're the members of a jury. And the second third of the film is now shot at eye level, and the final third, when it becomes really confrontational and everyone feels trapped, is shot from below eye level, so you can see ceilings. And his point here was really to make the room feel more cramped. Gives you an idea of how not just to convey power, but also the sense that when you see someone from below eye level, they can often seem a little cramped because the environment seems to be hovering over them a little more, especially if you start using longer focal length lenses that compress distance the way he did in this film.
One of the things, now I wish I remember who said it. It was a very famous early director, Stroheim or Lubitsch or somebody. Maybe somebody can post to our website and tell me where this quote came from. But the idea is, as a general rule of thumb, shoot angels from above and devils from below. Sort of the opposite of how you'd think you'd see them. You'd think of an angel in the sky and a devil under the earth or something like that, but it's sort of that opposite, but it's because of the psychological effect when you look at something from a different angle. I always like that.
A feature film is a term that was used to denote in the early days of film movies that were longer than the original single reel silent films, and single reels being generally 12 minutes or less. And we usually talk about them starting with The Birth of a Nation in 1915, but you know, that sort of proved that the feature film could be a hugely successful commercial venture. There were a lot of films that were features before this. So my question for you, Sam, this week is, what was the very first feature film?
Multiple reel film, so feature, that could be 20 minutes.
Right, it's not. I'll tell you this, it's longer than that. It's actually a fairly lengthy movie, especially for when it came out.
Okay, well, I have no idea, but I'm going to think about it over the next hour or so. Think of everything that makes you, you. All of the defining experiences and relationships of your life, your earliest memories, growing up, school, work, hobbies, friends, all the passions and fears and ambitions and dreams, everything, all at once. Do it now. Everything that means something to you and has shaped who you are now. Now, look down a crowded street or a shopping mall, or imagine it if there are no crowds nearby you at the moment. Just tons and tons of anonymous people milling around, right? Okay, I want you to think about how much stuff you were just thinking about yourself in your own life and multiply it by the hundreds or thousands of people out there on that crowded city street. That's how much life experience is right there in front of you, and you have no idea what it all is. You're missing out on every last bit of it. All those ideas, insights, dreams, all right there inside those heads that are right in front of your eyes, and you're just completely in the dark. Well, what I'm trying to illustrate here is how we define people in our minds by what we know about them, and maybe never even realize how much we don't know about them. But how many people really know you? For example, let's say you go to a particular restaurant or a shop regularly, and you kind of get to recognize the people that work there, and they get to recognize you, and you exchange friendly words whenever you show up and whatever. To you, those people are the people who work at that restaurant or store or whatever. But that's, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's this whole wealth of experience of family life, professional, love life, hobbies, who knows what kind of inner passions in there that are just closed off to you, and you may see that person every day. And, you know, the same goes for everybody. I have an aunt who teaches second grade, and she was asked one time by her students if she was going to be sad being all alone over Christmas vacation. It was kind of funny because we've kind of figured that the kid thought that my aunt, the teacher, just spent the entire time in that one classroom, and when the kids left, she just waited for them to come back, and so she was going to be all alone over Christmas vacation because the kids weren't going to be there. It's very cute, but when you think about it, that is how we think about people. To these students, my aunt is the teacher, and of course, to me, she's my aunt. So, you know, the reason I bring all this up, and, you know, thanks for bearing with me, is that most movies sort of conform to this limited view. You know, in almost every movie, there's one, maybe two main characters that we're supposed to identify with, and everyone else in the movie, no matter how big the cast is, all the other characters are defined in terms of their relationships to those one or two main characters. So the parent is the parent, and the sibling's the sibling, and the best friend's the best friend, teacher's the teacher, the boss is the boss, the paperboy is the paperboy. It goes on. No one else in the movie has lives apart from how they interact with the main characters. And that never strikes us as odd, because that's the way we perceive the co-stars in our own lives. So, you know, funny thing, really. But even if it doesn't happen very often, the movies are well-suited to providing us with a broader, more privileged perspective at life. And that finally brings me to our subject for this week's film spotlight, and it's called Shortcuts, and it was made in 1993 by director Robert Altman, that we are fond of talking about on the show because he was definitely a great director and a unique director. This movie is unusual, probably not for Altman, though, who's famous for making these kinds of movies, but this movie is unusual for giving us a first-hand perspective at the lives of not one, not two, but 22 different characters that all intersect in interesting ways, and none of them are ever able to appreciate how complicated the interconnections are. They, as in real life, each of these characters has their own view, their own self-centered view, and they only perceive the others as they relate to themselves. But we, the audience, can really see the whole picture, and that is just a value in broadening our own horizons and perspectives of how life really works. For example, a baker relates to one of his customers only as a customer who is indecisive about what she wants, not as somebody who is undergoing a great personal tragedy at the time. And there's this great scene where two characters go to pick up sets of pictures that they've had developed, and there's a mix-up, and they each get the other's pictures and start to look at them before they realize the mistake. And this is kind of a funny scene because you know, the pictures, if you don't know the stories behind them, are kind of funny to have seen or even shocking to have seen. But we, the audience, have seen why both these sets of pictures exist. But they relate to each other only in the sense that they've seen each other's pictures accidentally, and so then they swap them and they move on, and they never really figure out the whole story. And I just think that's a really interesting thing that this movie does that you don't really get from the movies that often, even though the medium is pretty well suited to giving us different perspectives. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing. Of course, it's tough to give you a lot of different perspectives because it's just difficult to write stories that work that way. And so one of the interesting things about Shortcuts is that there isn't really a central storyline at all. It's sort of a meandering kind of movie. There's a bunch of individual storylines, but even then they're not really sort of the classical stories in which people are trying to overcome some simple problem. They're more, I mean, it feels almost like a documentary. Like if you just take people at random and talk about a couple of days of their life, what would you see and what would you find out? Certainly there is a sort of climax to the film, but it doesn't at all follow, I think, conventional storytelling. That's one of the things that probably makes it difficult to make these kinds of movies.
Yeah, it's pretty open-ended. I wouldn't say that it's certainly dramatic. There's a lot of drama in here, and a lot of comedy as well, that's compressed into the same window of time, you know. But it is open-ended. You get the sense that these people live lives prior to the first frame and continue living them after it's over.
Yeah, in fact, it kind of just opens abruptly, too, without really much explanation of who anyone is, and you really have to work a little bit to piece out who all these characters are, and it's kind of difficult, in fact, at first, to try, okay, who is he, who is that, was she the person from the other story, and since they keep intersecting, it's a little confusing to keep track of. It helps that so many of the actors in this movie are people who, today, I think, if you're a movie buff, you know very well.
Yeah. Yeah, and some people weren't at the time. Julianne Moore, I think, made her name with this movie, but and there were other people that were on the ends of their careers. You know, Jack Lemmon. Well, he still had a good decade of work left in him, but it's certainly one of his latter performances, and he's great in it too.
Yeah, I was actually one thing I was impressed about watching this. I just saw it for the first time recently. Was the number of people who, I mean, it kind of reads like a cast of people who are going to be sort of stars in the 90s, or who were just becoming stars. People like Tim Robbins. You know, Tim Robbins wasn't a big star in the 80s, but during the 90s he will become one, and he's one of the central characters in this movie. Frances McDormand, kind of the same thing. She was, you know, been around. She made some movies prior to this, but you mentioned Julianne Moore, same kind of thing. I mean, just lots of people who are going to really become more and more popular as the decade progresses. It's kind of cool to see so many of them in the same movie. So, I mean, that helps.
Yeah, so in a sense, it might be easier to watch it now than it was at the time.
Absolutely, because you have these faces that you recognize and can latch onto. Oh, okay, that's the Frances McDormand character, that's the Julianne Moore character, etc.
Yeah. Well, let's give a little bit of background of this movie. It's based on a collection of short stories by Raymond Carver. And these stories were all originally independent stories that told some little vignette, or usually that illustrates some way in which people aren't really able to communicate with each other, which fits in with our theme. And the movie takes all these different stories and interlocks them together. So that's an innovation of the movie. And we get this larger tapestry of these interweaving stories. And it's not too, you know, some of these, like people criticize Crash for being a little too coincidental. It's not coincidental. It just happens to be the story is about people whose lives intersect. It's not that the intersections themselves are far-fetched or anything. But this style, I think, is a brilliant way to drive home the themes here. There's one story thread that was original to the movie about a depressed lounge singer. Honestly, I thought that was the one that should have been cut. I thought that was the weak link in the stories. What'd you think?
No, actually,
maybe it does need to be there.
Well, I don't. Do any of them need to be there? I'm not certain that any of them, standing on their own, you can't say that the movie depends on any specific story.
Yeah, probably not.
But, I mean, certainly each one of them adds to the tapestry.
Yeah. Well, that's true, I guess. I guess I just found that one the least compelling to me. But all the others I did find quite compelling, either tragic or funny or whatever. There's a lot of different tones that this movie strikes. But this interlocking structure, of course, is one that Altman was already comfortable with, as I mentioned, with The Player even the previous year, although that one was a little more focused on a central character. Nashville definitely follows that template.
Yeah, I think kind of invented the genre with Nashville.
I mean, they experimented with this sort of thing in the 30s with Grand Hotel and the women and that sort of thing, but definitely Altman reinvented that, and now he's known for that sort of style. And, you know, it'd be copied in Magnolia and Crash that I mentioned before, but I think Shortcut speaks loudest to me of all of these types of movies. I just found it to be hugely entertaining and covering the broadest spectrum of life that I could personally identify with, even if it's, I mean, most of these people I don't actually identify with, but I understood what the movie was doing in conveying the states of mind and the emotions and the things that people were wrestling with. And it was hilarious, I thought. I mean, there aren't really any punchlines to the humor, but just some of the situations that arise quite naturally by the characters being themselves are just so outrageous when you think about it. It's a riot. And then there are also moments of great tragedy that are quite moving. So I think both the comedy and the drama portions of this are, I think they're all the more effective, actually, because this movie is not packaged into a genre. It's a lot more like life, in which, you know, there's any number of situations can arise, and the movie is surprising and shocking and unpredictable in this fashion. True to life, you know, just when things seem settled and ordinary, something happens that snaps you to attention. And it's a different kind of thing each time. It might be a sudden moment of humor, or horror, or of tragedy, or maybe there's somebody you know, and you have your own perspective of that character, and suddenly a new facet of that character comes to light and is revealed and shows us that they're real people after all, not like the stereotypes that a few people seem to be like. I mean, it's that kind of movie. You think you've got all the characters figured out, and then suddenly it turns out they're human.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a couple of, for me, really key dramatic scenes that really anchor it. The story about the family whose son is struck by a car, I think that's probably, in my opinion, was the strongest of them all. And I mean, that one really, really works for me. And and there's some moments in there that just ring so true and are so powerful, despite the film not at all being heavy-handed. In fact, it's pretty impressive to me in a way how objective it feels as it just sort of observes these people and, you know, let's understand them, but it never gets too close or manipulative at all. I guess what I'm trying to say is that it doesn't feel at all like it's trying to stir our heartstrings. It makes us feel emotions without really playing them up necessarily. We watch characters and we empathize with them.
Yeah, the characters are allowed to be themselves. These people are allowed to exist. They're not. You get the sense in a lot of, and that's what I was trying to get at when I talked about movies that are packaged into genres. Lots of times, genre movies can be fun, but you really lots of times get the sense that these people are forced into these roles. Okay, you're the best friend, you're the tragic hero, you're the comic relief and whatever, and you don't get the sense that they're really behaving like real people. And here's a movie that doesn't have those requirements. It just opens up and says, okay, you are this person, you're this person, you're this person, now behave like it. Obviously, this cannot possibly be spontaneous, but you almost get that sense, you know, that wow, that happened. That's too bad. Not, why did they make that happen? It's that really happened.
Yeah, there is, I think, one moment. We talked about this before we recorded, though. One moment at the very end of the film, sort of the resolution of the Chris Penn storyline that I still don't know if I buy it. It seems like it almost just comes from the screenwriter's pen more than it does.
Really?
Yeah, I still can't quite wrap my head around it. It's tough to talk about. It's a spoiler, so I won't get into it too much. But other than that, I mean, in a movie that runs 3 hours and 10 minutes, to only have one real quibble with it, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I don't have that problem with that at all. I guess we sort of talked about why that was. Maybe we'll open up a thread on the website to talk about the spoiler stuff, but I like that story, actually, because, you know, when the movie ends, it's kind of funny. We talked about it being open-ended, but I remember when I watched this the first time, it was pretty disconcerting because the credits started rolling. And my first reaction was, what? That's it? You know, the movie's over? What? And it's 3 hours long. And so, of course, it's got to end at some point. But my brain, you know, trained as it is, unfortunately, on these prepackaged stories, was just not expecting something to happen that we didn't completely understand. Then have the movie end before it's all tidied up. It took me a few days, actually, of thinking back on the movie, because this movie just wouldn't leave my head. It's not like I purposely sat down and thought about it. It's just that what naturally happened is I was thinking about this movie, and that's a sign of a good movie if it really sticks in your head. But after a few days, the movie started making more sense to me, and I started understanding what the movie was doing. I mean, there is closure to these stories, but if you don't have all the answers, it's because in real life, we really don't have all the answers. We can't explain everything that everybody does by the end of whatever their stories or our stories or whatever. There are things that are always closed off from us. So you think of just anything in your life. You know somebody who does something. Why did he do that? You know, you want to go ask him, why did you do that? And his answer may or may not be satisfactory. There is something like that happens here, maybe even a couple things that are more minor. And if you think about it, you can come up with an explanation, I think, that makes sense. It may not be convincing as this is what happened, but you can sort of think how something like that would happen because things like that do happen in real life. And so you can almost sort of see things in hindsight that may have led up to this particular unexpected action.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the ending? One thing I think is interesting when I think of other movies kind of like this, you mentioned Magnolia, or another movie that really comes to mind for me is the Three Colors trilogy by Krzysztof Kieslowski.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I mean, both of those, I mean, the end of Red, which is the final of the Three Colors movies, and the end of Magnolia, both have sort of like clear climaxes that have a lot of, in my mind, real emotional power. And Shortcuts kind of has one, but I'm not sure it's at all as big and grand as the other movies. Do you think that works for or against Shortcuts?
with the event that ties things together in the end.
Yeah, but it's not really. I mean, it's not at all like the other two films that I mentioned, the way that they really tie things together. I mean, the end of Shortcuts doesn't at all seem as abrupt or as much of an ending. Like you mentioned, not as much closure necessarily.
Yeah. I think that the purpose of the event at the end of Shortcuts is a little different than what you see in The Three Colors or Magnolia. I think the idea is not so much to signal, okay, now here comes the climactic moment in everybody's lives. I think that's more what I get out of the other movies. In Shortcuts, it just seems to me like a signal that, hey, we're all living in the same world, and these things are happening all around us. All these different lives are happening, and, you know, it's difficult to communicate. You can establish some communications, but it's difficult to know all of the rich and plentiful and dramatic stuff that's happening around us, but we're all in the same world, and we're all experiencing the same environment. That's kind of more the signal I get from Shortcuts, rather than it being the climax of all the stories.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah. So I want to mention the cast real quick here. We did mention some of them, but it is an incredible cast, as we mentioned. And, of course, Jack Lemmon, one of my favorite actors, and he has a dramatic role here with a key speech that is just amazing. I think a real high point of the movie. Also, Julianne Moore, who has since become one of my favorite actresses, a very incredible moment there. Frances McDormand, who is brilliant in Fargo, is hilarious here. I think she has the funniest story and performance. Do you think?
Yeah, probably. I mean, especially because it overlaps with the other funny one, which is the Tim Robbins story.
Yeah, yeah. And she plays a woman whose relationship with men just really don't work out. There's no other way to put it. And her performance is just a complete riot toward the end. And maybe all the more so because deep down it's so true to human nature. I really get sick of the comedies that are mugging for the camera and grinning and trying to do... It's about people trying to be funny, and that's not funny. What's funny is when people are themselves and they're funny. They happen to be funny. And so this has more of a spontaneous nature. It's true to human nature. This is how people really behave. That's why a lot of these stand-up comics talk so much about love or marriage or kids or whatever. These same themes tend to come up a lot because it's part of the human experience. It's not Bill Cosby sitting up there saying, oh, yeah, he's not talking about clowns. He's talking about being a father or something like that, and that's why he was funny. So there's a lot of that type of humor, although a little more cutting and biting, but also good in this. Andie MacDowell, who's, you know, her performances can be pretty variable, I think, but I think she's great here. And, of course, Lily Tomlin is always great. Madeline Stowe, Robert Downey Jr., Ann Archer, Tim Robbins, we said, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Chris Penn, Lyle Lovett, again, another one I'm not always crazy about, but is good here. Lily Taylor, Huey Lewis even, actually. He's not normally known for movie appearances, and he didn't really ask to do a lot of acting, but it's just neat to see all these different faces, and it really adds to the texture of the movie.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's one of those fun things. It's just sort of, as the character's introduced, like, oh, hey, that's, you know, whoever it is, and be like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So to wrap things up here, I don't know many other movies that have taken me more by surprise than this movie. Of course, a lot of that was that I had no idea what it was like going into it, and I wasn't even familiar with Robert Altman's work, frankly. This was sort of my introduction to him, although I had seen other movies of his and not known it. But even so, the things that happen in this are just so unpredictable, as I said. I just hate walking into a movie and being able to predict everything that's going to happen, because it's set everything up according to a formula. You never know in this, and these characters never know, and what's around the corner, and if it's something good or bad or funny or sad, as in life. And not only that, but sometimes what happens to these characters is huge and life-changing, and sometimes it's just the ordinary day-to-day living. And somehow this movie is fascinating to watch either way. That's really weird. But, you know, it's a striking thing, how authentic all this feels. It doesn't feel like something maybe based on life, but artificially trumped up for dramatic effect. Even the complicated interconnections of characters doesn't really feel all that far-fetched, because the whole premise of the movie is that maybe this kind of thing happens all the time to us, and we just never see the whole picture. The first part of a movie that makes an impression on you is the title. Before you even go in to see it, the title perhaps tells you a little bit about what it is. And some titles are very creative. They can be funny in and of themselves. And so this week's top six list is going to be the top six funniest movie titles. This isn't considering the movie itself at all. Maybe we'll consider the context of the movie, but it could be an absolutely terrible, unfunny movie, but with a hilarious title, it'll make this list. So let's get started. My number six funny movie title is I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With, made in 2006, quite a recent film. It speaks for itself.
Never heard of that movie. I've tried to avoid movies that are a little too obscure. I have one that's pretty obscure, but otherwise, going for funny movie titles, maybe you've had a chance of hearing of at one point in time. So my number six was Snakes on a Plane. Just a wonderfully descriptive title that pretty much tells you what the movie's going to be about.
Yep, yep. And I did go for obscure titles, so maybe we'll get a good mix this time. My number five, however, not that obscure. It's The Talented Mr. Ripley from 1999. And if that doesn't sound funny, well, consider the title as it actually appears when you watch the movie. It's not The Talented Mr. Ripley at all. It's The Mysterious, Yearning, Secretive, Sad, Lonely, Troubled, Confused, Loving, Musical, Gifted, Intelligent, Beautiful, Tender, Sensitive, Haunted, Passionate, Talented Mr. Ripley.
That's a mouthful. My number five is not at all a mouthful, and it's Scary Movie, the spoof of horror movies, which is even funnier if you know that the original working title for the Scream series, which was also a sort of a parody, though not quite nearly in the same vein, was simply Scary Movie. And the original title of Scary Movie was some really long sort of amalgamation of all those other movie titles, but it was something like, you know, Scream, if you know what I did last summer.
Oh, no, that's a different movie.
No, that movie... That movie actually took the title from the original working title of Scary
Movie. Oh, really?
Movie. Yeah.
Oh, how strange. Okay.
So, yeah, that was the original title of a Scary Movie. Then they just switched it to Scary Movie.
It reminds me of Mel Brooks' Silent Movie. And, of course, now we have things like Date Movie and I don't know what else, a whole Scary Movie Spawn. Anyway, my number four, The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Mixed Up Zombies from 1964, featured on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah, I knew you'd pick it, so I didn't have to. My number four is very similar, and it is Night of the Day of the Dawn of the Son of the Bride of the Return of the Revenge of the Terror of the Attack of the Evil Mutant Alien Flesh-Eating Hellbound Zombified Living Dead Part 2 in shocking 2D. this is a kind of weird, obscure cult movie that's just a spoof. Well, actually, they took the original Night of the Living Dead, which is not under copyright, and just redubbed it, kind of like What's Up, Tiger Lily. And it, of course, has the great title, my favorite part being the in shocking 2D.
Yes. My number three, The Fearless Vampire Killers, or, pardon me, but your teeth are in my neck.
And don't you hate it when that happens?
Yeah.
My number three, I think everyone knows, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, a perfectly irreverent title for the best nuclear holocaust comedy out there.
Yes, it was. All right, my number two, Rat Fink a Boo Boo, which is, it doesn't make any sense. It makes me... laugh just saying that, but it's even funnier when you consider that the original title was supposed to be Rat Fink and Boo Boo. These are two kind of superhero characters or something, and the movie was so low budget that when the title screen came back with a typographical error and the "and" was just A, the director didn't have enough money to fix the problem, so the title is really Rat Fink a Boo Boo.
Fantastic. I like that a lot. Well, my number two movie was the surprise hit of the year, Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan.
I know somebody who likes to vacation there.
Interesting. That's a weird choice.
He's a weird guy. My number one is a movie based on the stage play of the same name. It is Oh Dad, Poor Dad, Mama's Hung You in the Closet, and I'm Feeling So Sad.
Yeah, that would probably make me pretty sad, too. Well, my number one is just one of my all-time favorite movie titles. I must make a joke based on it constantly. And it's Die Hard 2, Die Harder, with a potential honorable mention to Die Hard 4, Live Free, or Die Hard. But I think Die Hard 2, Die Harder, you can really just take anything and just make a sequel title, you know, Star Trek 2, Star Trekker, for instance. I just love it.
Last week we talked about Stanley Kubrick, one of the greatest of all directors, and we talked about some of the themes in his work and the way he worked. And this week we want to continue that just by going through film by film and talking just a little bit about each one. From 1951 to 1953, he made a bunch of short documentaries, and that's how he got his start. I haven't seen them, but by all accounts they don't really show you much about the filmmaker that he would become, so we'll skip right past that. But he never did return to documentaries. I guess that really wasn't what he was interested in. His first feature film was Fear and Desire from 1953, famously very difficult to find because he hated the movie. He thought it was an amateur work, and he restricted its distribution, and now he's died. He died in 1999, and we still can't get it because his estate don't really want it seen either, because he didn't want it seen. So we'll just move straight on to Killer's Kiss from 1955, kind of a noir movie, and it does touch upon an early theme. We talked about dehumanization last week. This one isn't about dehumanization, but the one sequence in this movie that makes it stand out, that makes it more than just a B-movie that's not that good, there is a great sequence in it involving mannequins. There's a chase through this room, this empty warehouse or something, where there's just mannequins absolutely everywhere, and he picks up the dead faces on the mannequins as they're being pushed around as the chase happens, and there's just something about that scene that's really creepy. And so if you look at Killer's Kiss, you can look at this scene and say, hey, Kubrick is starting to get it. He's starting to come alive with his own style. And by The Killing, the next year, 1956, it was just suddenly blossomed. This is a brilliant movie. It's my favorite heist movie, perhaps. It's certainly up there. And for one thing, there is something that's very different about this one than later movies. It is tight. A lot of his later movies are epic in scope. This one is trim and short and packs a huge punch. It takes you through this heist from the perspective of several different characters, jumbled up in time somewhat, like you'd see one character's piece of the heist, and then later on you'd see some other pieces going on at the same time, or even before that, that set up the other piece. You know, I mean, it sounds complicated. The film makes it clear to you when you watch it, and it starts a trend of his, which is taking on an existing genre and an existing work. This was based on a prior work. It wasn't an original screenplay. Take these existing things and use them as springboards to jump off a foundation so he could make his own thing out of that and turn it into an original work. And so we think of a lot of his movies as original works, even though they're not. It's kind of strange, but quite interesting. And then in the next year, 1957, he makes the movie Paths of Glory. And Stephen, I heard you just saw this, so why don't you talk about that one a little bit?
Well, yeah, it's a war movie, but not really a conventional war movie. It's about French troops during World War I and this assault on a German position that fails. And the general who was in charge of the assault becomes completely irate that it failed, and that the men, they were rushing to the position and just got cut down by machine gun fire and artillery blasts, and so they simply retreated without being ordered to do so. And so the general orders that a bunch of them be brought up on charges of cowardice and shot. And Kirk Douglas plays the colonel in charge of this regiment who sort of sticks up for them against this general and acts as their defense during the court-martial. And I actually, going in, I thought it was a war movie, but it's not at all a conventional war movie. There's only really the one action sequence, and that's pretty detached, though. Man, that sequence features a really wonderful tracking shot sort of alongside the troops as they go forward and then sort of back along as they end up retreating. But mainly it becomes just a psychological movie about these different characters, particularly Douglas and the general played by George MacReady. This battle of wills between two men, and it's very Kubrickian in the way that it explores its themes. You can also see him definitely sort of developing many of his trademark camera styles, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you mentioned one tracking shot. There's another one, and we talked about reverse tracking shots last week. There's another one of these in this,
yeah.
Where that Colonel Dax is going through the trenches, and he's talking to some of the men as he walks by, sort of inspecting things, and the camera's directly in front of him and goes backward as he walks forward, and this is brilliant. I should have thought of it for my top six tracking shots list from episode 14. It's just brilliant. And of course, what makes it brilliant isn't just that the shot is theatrical, but what's happening within it. You know, there's great dialogue in here, and it really helps set up the mentalities of the officers toward the men and vice versa, and that will be kind of the crux of the movie, you know, which is summed up by the quote, "One way to maintain discipline is to shoot a man now and then."
one of their great tracking shot is the tracking shot that's right in front of people looking at them, and it's these men walking to an execution. We just focus on this long march as these people know that they're going to be shot shortly. And wow, that is just an amazing moment.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, ooh.
It's effective, even though, just for some factual accuracy here, the French military did shoot people for cowardice. They did not do it in as a spectacle kind of thing. It was a private sort of thing. And they didn't pick people at random, which is the idea of this, is the cowardice of many, and we can't execute everybody, so we'll pick some people and make an example of them. They didn't do that either. But, you know, whatever. This is as a movie, in its internal reality, is absolutely fantastic and devastatingly chilling. But that brings up the end. What do you think about the ending of this?
You mean the scene in the bar?
Yeah, because basically the ending, without giving too much away, I don't think this spoils anything. We get the main story done with, and then there's this final chapter that doesn't really have anything to do with the main story, but it does definitely, I think, have everything to do with the theme. But how did that hit you when you saw that last scene? This is a very memorable ending.
Oh, yeah, I thought it was brilliant. Like you said, at first I was kind of confused, where was this going? And then I realized that it reminded me a lot of Renoir's Grand Illusion.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of found a way for people of different nationalities who are allegedly fighting one another to sort of find a shared humanity. It was very silent, very quiet and sad.
Yeah.
I think really worked well, like you said, for the theme of the movie. It really drove it home. Without being too obvious.
Yeah.
An interesting choice.
Yeah. It's something to think about, too. The woman in that who does the singing in that last scene there wound up being Kubrick's wife. All right, well, let's move on to Spartacus from 1960, and this is his only real big Hollywood movie. He had made a name for himself with his previous three movies, and so Kirk Douglas was serving as the actor and producer on a movie, this Roman epic Spartacus, and directed by Anthony Mann. And I guess between Mann and Douglas there was a bit of a clash, a personality conflict or something. So Douglas fired him and hired Kubrick because he remembered working with him on Paths of Glory, and I guess that was a good experience. This one was not, however. I guess they didn't really like each other after they finished Spartacus. Kubrick was not one for compromise, a clash of strong wills, I guess. Ultimately, Kubrick disowned the movie. He didn't like Spartacus at all. He wasn't happy with the way the Hollywood executives kept trying to meddle with him, and he was so fed up that he actually moved to England after that movie and finished out his career there. He just lived there and made movies there the rest of his life. But I don't personally think that the film betrays all that turmoil. I think it's a good entry in the historical epic genre that was real fad at the time. I mean, one of the best is very character-centered epic, which I think is the key. You want the big spectacle, but you don't want to lose the characters when you're giving that.
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to rank at the top of the Kubrick movies either.
Well, another one I don't think will either is Lolita from 1962, although it does start to really define Kubrick as the filmmaker he would become. It's the first of many controversial works he would do. As I said last week, it's very heavily censored, but the suggestion that's left in there is pretty creepy, too. And some great, great performances by James Mason and Peter Sellers. So, you know, unsettling work, but very well crafted.
2 years later, in 1964, we get my favorite Kubrick movie, and perhaps my favorite comedy, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. I mean, there aren't many movies that could effectively be a parody of the Cold War at the height of the Cold War. I mean, here's a movie that makes nuclear holocaust absolutely hilarious, and I think, you know, this is definitely where all of Kubrick's themes really come into play. We get that constant cynicism. This is one of the most cynical movies ever. I mean, the whole basic premise is that us humans are so dumb that we're going to eventually cause our own destruction, but let's have a laugh about it at least if we can. And it also features a lot of, you know, sort of other Kubrickian elements. The idea of machines gotten a little amok, and the interchangeability between humans and machines, even when humans are in charge of it. I mean, there's all these mechanical failures that are going to kind of set up the ultimate destruction of humanity. But I think a lot of the joke is that even the parts that are controlled by humans are just as bad and just as mechanical and non-thinking, because this is what happens to us when we get locked into a specific mode of thinking. In this case, I think, you know, that mode of thinking is the us versus them mentality of the Cold War era. I mean, it's interesting that it's got a lot to say while being just ridiculously funny, kind of mixing a bit of slapstick and a little bit of screwball and just farce and brilliant dialogue. And who can forget that? I think probably my favorite scene in the entire film is one toward the end where the Russians have launched their nukes, essentially, and the Americans are basically just waiting around to die. And Dr. Strangelove, played by Peter Sellers, starts talking about how, well, perhaps we could build some giant mine shafts. We could all go live in them. And, of course, we'd have to bring 10 women for every man so we could repopulate the world. And they start thinking, well, what if the Soviets, what if they have mine shafts as well? What if they have more than us? And we got to close the mine shaft gap. So even as they're facing their own destruction, all that they can think about is the Soviet response and how they got to one-up them. absolutely hilarious and bitter and oh, I don't know.
Yeah, one of the reasons it works is absolutely straight-faced.
All the way through,
there's
yeah.
no winking at the camera. And yet, I say straight-faced, but literally that's not quite true, because George C. Scott doesn't have a single straight face in the whole movie. He's just so ridiculously over the top. It's hilarious. I mean, you have not seen scenery chewing. I think he's on our top six list of scenery chewing performances, he's number one. Although we should note that he didn't like his own performance in the movie, actually, and he kind of resented the way Kubrick got it out of him. He was somehow persuaded by Kubrick to do a couple of takes that were just so far over the top, it was ridiculous. But Kubrick said, well, we won't use these takes. And of course he did. So, you know, it might not have been the right personal way to go about it, but certainly the right artistic decision, because, gosh, it's absolutely right for this movie. And then Peter Sellers, of course, plays several different characters and does them all really well. He delivers the most famous line, or at least for me, my favorite line in it. Gentlemen, please, there's no fighting in here. This is the war room. And speaking of the war room, that was one of the great sets, too, by the great set designer Ken Adam, who would later work with Kubrick on Barry Lyndon and win an Oscar for his work there. And then, just as a footnote, the same year, saying something about how this movie has endured, the same year, Sidney Lumet, also a great director that we probably should spotlight sometime, made a movie called Failsafe, which is practically the same story, but told as a serious thriller with Henry Fonda as the president, and that's also an excellent film, but it just shows you how powerful satire is as an art form, and also how good Kubrick was at putting it together. The Dr. Strangelove is the one that has proven so timeless, long outlasting the Cold War paranoia of its day. It still works, even though the Cold War is over. So that's really interesting about it. So his next movie was 1968, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Do you have any words for this one?
Yeah, I think we've talked about it before, and I feel like this has somewhere in it the greatest science fiction film of all time, and that it also has a lot of extraneous stuff. I mean, the 20-minute light show after the approach to Jupiter?
Yeah.
What is that?
I think the Hal David stuff is just brilliant. The stuff with the classical music as we're zooming through space is wonderful, and then it just has all this clutter as well. It's weird for a Kubrick movie. They're usually pretty tight. I mean, even the big movies.
Yeah. You know, I even like the Dawn of Man sequences.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the other stuff, the middle part with the stuff on the moon, and the very ending, I just can't get behind. I feel like conceptually it's wonderful, and there's some just great executed pieces, but I don't know, I just feel like it could have been tighter.
And part of it is he threw out the narrative. I mean, if you're going to keep the sequence, keep the narrative to it. If you read the book, then all that stuff at the end actually makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, but, you know, well, I mean, apparently Kubrick and Clark kind of disagreed on that. I mean, it's not really fair to say that 2001 is based on the novel. It was sort of, they worked together. The novel was actually published after the movie came out. It was based originally on a short story that Clark wrote called The Sentinel, which only really covers the moon segment of the film, when they find the monolith on the moon. But apparently Kubrick did not want the ending of the film to be understandable, whereas the book makes it quite clear.
Yeah, so, he didn't want it, but it's,
I mean,
it's,
I don't know,
it's presented in a way that you think it should be. I don't know. That's my take on it anyway. It's something doesn't work about it.
Well, moving on to A Clockwork Orange, 1971, I think it's his most disturbing film. It's certainly difficult to watch. I didn't enjoy it, but I did admire it, I think. It's interesting. It's about violence in society and punishment and rehabilitation, about brainwashing, about moral choices, about the freedom to make moral choices. Complicated stuff. Sounds kind of pretentious, actually. Maybe it even is. I don't know. But there's something fascinating about it that you just can't stop watching, even though you want to, perhaps. I'm not sure I understand all of what the movie is trying to say, but it's evocative just by virtue of exploring these ideas, and again, exploring them further than most people are comfortable going, which is why this is such a controversial and unpleasant movie. So you can sense I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, it is powerful, it is sick, it is compelling, it's nasty, it's outrageous, but it's very pointed about making us think and feel in specific sorts of ways, and it keeps our interest and keeps us watching, and so it's hard not to admire it on that level, even if ultimately you come away and say, you know what, I hate it. And I didn't say that, but you know, it's not something I'd watch for fun.
You know, interesting. I think I liked it a bit more than you, but I agree with most of your assessment. No, it's interesting. Maybe we should mention it here. We've talked about how so many of Kubrick's films are adaptations, and this is no different. But also, it's interesting how often the people who wrote the original source material weren't that pleased with the adaptation. I mean, famously, Stephen King really dislikes the adaptation of The Shining. We mentioned the disagreements between Clark and Kubrick in 2001, but the book A Clockwork Orange by Anthony Burgess has a different ending. I mean, actually, what it is, it has all the stuff that's in the movie, but then there's an additional chapter that basically shows the main character growing up and stop being the way that he is. Very interesting. So many Kubrick movies just riddled with these weird stories. There's some rumors that Kubrick didn't originally read the same version of the novel that included that ending, or I think the consensus is that Kubrick was aware of that ending and just didn't like it and preferred to end this way. You know, Kubrick's not a very upbeat kind of guy. His movies are rarely very hopeful, and this one does definitely not have a hopeful ending, and I guess purposely removed it. I don't know, what do you think? Do you think it would have worked better with a happier ending?
No, I don't think so. I think after the first act is over, it gets much better and more palatable for me. You know, this is the early sequences of his crimes early on that are pretty disturbing. And once he goes through the rehabilitation stages, those are just absolutely fascinating. And then the consequences, a little less so, but still, I think, effective. So his next movie comes in 1975, and it's a real change of pace. It's a lot more subdued and quiet compared to the Kubrick movies that you might expect, especially after A Clockwork Orange. But it's Barry Lyndon, and it's a period piece. And some people say it's, you know, the best costume drama ever made, and I don't know if I go that far. It's pretty great, though. And one of the amazing things about Barry Lyndon isn't so much the story, but the look. And there are two reasons for this, that it doesn't look like any other film. And they're both lenses. He used two different types of lenses that nobody ever really used in a movie before. For the outdoor scenes, landscape shots and so forth, he used this zoom lens, and you zoom way in and shoot people from very far away. And what that does for you is it flattens the image out. You don't get the same sense of depth in the background. Instead, you get the sense that you're looking at a painting, and everything is on the same plane. And in fact, the cinematography of Barry Lyndon was set up very purposefully to look like 18th century paintings, the time where this story is set. And it's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, you can just hit the pause button at any number of points in the movie and imagine that frame hanging on a wall somewhere in a museum. It's just wonderfully effective. The movie really looks like an 18th century pastoral painting or something come to life. And the second lens was used for the indoor scenes, or at least some of them. It was the super fast lens with a wide aperture. It actually has the widest aperture of any other movie ever. And what that did is it allowed the indoor scenes to be shot in candlelight. Now, normally you need an incredible amount of light to shoot a movie with a normal lens, you know, more than is natural, and then it comes across looking natural when you watch it. But Kubrick wanted to make the interiors look more realistic, and so he found a way to shoot with candlelight, which they would have used in the 18th century to light the inside. And so he shot by candlelight, and there are a number of indoor scenes where you see a close-up of a character speaking, and there are candles in the foreground. And if you've seen a lot of movies, this is actually really striking because no other movie has lighting that looks like this. But it works. And the downside however, is there's virtually no depth of focus at all in these low light levels. So in these scenes, the characters are all really still, because if they move around very much, they'll be out of focus just in an instant. That's not really a downside, though. It's a lack of freedom that is successfully navigated by the film. But there's actually a legend that Barry Lyndon was shot exclusively with natural lighting, and that actually isn't true. There are definitely scenes with artificial light, but the film does use natural light as much as possible and uses artificial lights in a naturalistic sort of way. So it does come across as having a very distinct look to it. And that takes us to The Shining in 1980, and we've talked a lot about this, so we'll be a little briefer than we would be. If you want to hear us talk about The Shining, go back to episodes 5, 13, and 14. But we mentioned how last week Kubrick was famous for doing dozens and dozens of takes of the same scenes. I mean, sometimes over 100. And The Shining is really where this reputation solidified. There's a couple of stories that come out of this. One of them is that one of the actors, Scatman Crothers, didn't have a lot of stamina for the kind of endless takes, and ultimately he just broke down and said, "What do you want, Mr. Kubrick?" Like, there's a real key scene with the character. Kubrick decided, okay, let's do 70 takes of this one. And he's deciding up front. And it was Jack Nicholson, actually, that persuaded him to say, hey, this guy is 70 years old. Maybe we could go easy on him, you know. And Kubrick said, yeah, okay, we'll just do 40. So, you know, that's kind of what it was like to work for Kubrick, I guess. And even also on The Shining, you know, there's that famous shot where the elevator doors open and all this tons of blood pours out, and it just cascades over and floods the hallway. And this was such a huge deal to shoot. It took 9 days to set it up for one take. And so they'd shoot it, and Kubrick would say, that doesn't look like blood. And so they have to take another 9 days to set up take two. Kind of an interesting story, but...
Yeah, you know, I love The Shining. I don't have much more to say about it that I haven't already said on the podcast either. So,
yeah.
Full Metal Jacket?
Full Metal Jacket. You want to take this one?
Okay, because I feel conflicted. I feel like kind of like I do on 2001, where I love part of it, and I'm not a huge fan of the rest of it, though. I absolutely just love the first half of the film, the basic training sequence, where it's just these characters going through Marine Corps boot camp, and it's brilliant, wonderfully done. I mean, Arlie Ermey, who got his break into acting here, originally was the military consultant on this movie, and again, I've heard different stories about how he ended up getting the job starring as the drill instructor. My favorite one, though, and one that I choose to believe is true, is that Kubrick saw a film or a video of Ermey standing, shouting insults for 20 minutes straight while people hurled oranges at him. So he's just getting barraged by oranges and just did not break off for 20 minutes just shouting the most vile insults he could come up with. And, of course, you know, he uses that character to great effect in the movies. And now you see Ermey pop up all the time anytime a movie needs a sort of good old leather neck to play a part. And, you know, Ermey was actually a drill instructor himself. I mean, what's interesting, too, is from what I understand, this movie is pretty authentic in terms of its portrayal of basic training. My brother, who is a Marine, said that they watched this movie in boot camp, and that interesting, because you mentioned that you think that Kubrick is very anti-military. Virtually everyone I know who's in the military loves this movie. I mean, I guess because it's based on a memoir, so you know there's some of that truth to it. But Kubrick went to pretty great lengths to get the details in this film right, and I definitely think it gives you a good idea of maybe, you know, obviously you can't really know what it's like with war or boot camp or really anything. It's like without experience in it. I think this might give you a pretty good look at what it might be like.
Yeah, and then as you say, it kind of spirals out of control from there. I mean, from there it moves on to something that's pretty meandering and not interesting, and then it winds up as an okay war action thing that's just not inspired. It's like Kubrick stopped directing it and somebody else took over. It's really weird.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to his last movie, Eyes Wide Shut, made all the way in 1999. He really took a while to make his next movie. And it's about another controversial subject, in particular, jealous obsession in the relationship between a husband and a wife. Basically, this man's wife confesses something unfaithful to him. She didn't actually do anything, but she said she wanted to be unfaithful or something. And that just... it's one of these things that gets deep down inside him and just takes hold and roots and just drives him absolutely nuts. And so he goes on this sort of nightmare odyssey through New York, and he sees and experiences all this depravity all around him. And it's very expressionistic. You don't get the sense that he's just dreaming all this, But you don't get the sense that it's all real necessarily either. It really feels like his external experiences are reflections of his inner turmoil, all these terrible feelings that are ravaging him. And he sorts through these feelings, and as he does that, he sorts through all these surreal problems in the external world as well. It's sort of an interesting, introspective sort of movie that I think when it came out, a lot of people were put off by it. But I think it's just a difficult movie to ingest. You have to really think about it and spend some time with it and give it some thought to sort of understand what's happening in the movie.
I have a kind of a different take on it. I agree with your assessment of the way of what it's doing and the way it's working, but I feel like it's a movie that it doesn't work if you think too much about it. It's a movie that's about feelings. That's about emotions, and I think in some ways...
Well, I definitely mean thinking about the feelings. I don't mean the plot. The plot, you don't think about that at all. Just think about how it makes you feel.
Right. I loved it. I absolutely loved it when I saw it in the movie theater when it first came out. I mean, I was like... It's weird, too, because it came out right after Kubrick died, so it was like, I went and saw it on opening weekend just, you know, as my own personal homage to Kubrick. I figured this is the last Kubrick movie I'd ever get to see on first release. But, I don't know, I really enjoy it. And but it's not a film I've ever watched again. I feel like I saw it once, I had that wonderful experience, and I feel like if I think about it too much, maybe it breaks down a little bit. I can understand why people are put off by it, but you kind of have to just go along with it. It's all about mood and all about feeling, and I think it works wonderfully well in the moment, and maybe not as well when you're not experiencing it.
Well, I don't know. I've only seen it the once either, but I don't think I have those same concerns. Certainly a good note to go out on, and so that is our tribute to Kubrick. I have no way to close this, so I'll just end it.
Sam, time to wrap up that trivia question, and we're looking for the title of the very first feature film, the very first film that was of a significantly longer length than the original, you know, 10-minute silent short films. Do you know what it was, or even when it was?
I'm going to just guess that it's an adaptation of some sort, probably a play or a book or something. And I won't narrow it down any further, because if I'm right, then I'm right. But if I do, then I don't have any chance at all.
Well, you got close. The first European feature film was actually just basically a straight stage play filmed. But before that, in 1906, an Australian film called The Story of the Kelly Gang, also known as Ned Kelly and His Gang, based on the Australian folklore outlaw hero, was released. It's a 70-minute film in 1906. I mean, wow.
Would you ever want to watch it?
Unfortunately, you can't. Oh. Only about 10 minutes of it survive. It was originally 70 minutes long, and we know a lot about it because it was a big deal. At that time, nothing that long had ever even... No one even really contemplated making it, and I guess it was successful in its day. But yeah, unfortunately, we only have a seventh of its total running time.
That's it for episode 34. The good news is that there will be, and this is official, an episode 35, and it'll be released next Tuesday on May 29th. In the meantime, you can go to our website, allmovietalk.com. That's spelled allmovietalk.com. And you can read a number of different posts about movies that we make throughout the week, the stuff that comes to our minds that doesn't ever make it onto the show. And you can also go to rinkworks.com, where you can see thousands of movie reviews, and we got a film lover's checklist and some humor and stuff like that about the movies. So what do we got next week?
Next week we have an industry trend segment looking all at the studio system. This was actually something a reader requested way back when on the website, so we'll talk all about what that means. And of course, Sam's going to have something about animated features, because you know he's crazy about them if you haven't gotten that sorted out by now. And he'll be talking all about the Disney animated features. And our top six list, for those of you who like to compose them in advance, is a personal one. It's the top six movies that we have seen over and over again. So ready your personal must-rewatch flicks, and get ready for us then on next Tuesday.
Cut. It's too early in the morning. Nobody should have a 3 a.m. call. I need Mountain Dew.